Good afternoon. I'm Stephen Shiragi. I'm the Scholl Chair in International Business at the Center for Strategic International Studies, and I want to welcome you all here. We couldn't be more pleased to have Secretary Dan Glickman, the current head of the Motion Picture Association of America, here today. This is part of our China speaker series on smart power and part of CSIS's ongoing U.S.-China Commission on U.S.-China Relations, co-chaired by former Secretary of Defense William Cohen and Hank Greenberg of CBC Star and Company, which is looking at constructive and effective approaches on America's engagement with China. And I think there's three core reasons why today's event couldn't be more timely or important. First is obviously the U.S.-China relationship. Many predict China is going to surpass the United States as the world's biggest economy. And in any event, our nation's fates, along with much of the world's global economic fate, are inseparably intertwined, to the point where many people are saying we shouldn't talk about a G7, a G8, or a G20, but a G2. So whatever your issue or perspective, there's a great chance that the U.S.-China relationship is going to have lasting ramifications on that. Second, and in terms of all those different issues, perhaps none is more important to the relationship in a long-term perspective, and also in terms of U.S. and world economic growth than the one that we're focusing on today. I think much of the world is rightly focused on the short term right now, stopping kind of the bleeding on the financial crisis that we've experienced, looking at stability. But in terms of long-term economic growth that's driven the world and the United States economics, intellectual property has been a key. And I think this is both a powerful opportunity. Creative and dynamic U.S. intellectual property presents perhaps our greatest export opportunity. And as I know Dan's going to talk in more detail, maybe it's our most effective and enduring way of international diplomacy, using smart power to spread values and messaging in ways that government programs or politics really can't match. But it's also a core economic challenge we face in the world economy, and particularly with China. How is the United States going to retain its core competitive advantage, much less remaining a leading economic power, if we're dependent on intellectual property that can be given away for free, or leaning on a world trading system that protects trade in goods, such as China exports, but doesn't have any really effective ways of looking at enforcement of intellectual property around the world? And it's not just the United States. It's the question of how do we build a system where innovation and trade has led the greatest spread of human development over the last 100 years, but how, and it's going to be dependent on that in terms of growing out of the current economic crisis. Internet and broadband add a whole new dimension to this with growth exponentially and new challenges. And we've got to look at IPR not just in terms of some of the obvious things, but how it affects things like manufacturing, like agriculture, and in the range of this whole complex China relationship we have. And that comes to the third reason and the key reason why I think we couldn't be more excited about being here today, and that's Dan Glickman. There's perhaps no person that comes at these complex and important issues with the range of perspectives and experiences of our speaker here today. He currently leads an organization that's at the forefront of American creativity and messaging to the world. And his experience also goes far beyond that in terms of academics at Harvard's Kennedy School, dealing with a lot of the key political challenges we face, in terms of being in government as a key cabinet secretary under the Clinton administration, when they negotiated the opening of China to the World Trade Organization, which I don't have to tell the people in this world, restructured and rethought the entire U.S.-China relationship and also reshaped the world economy in terms of its impact over the last several years. And as a new administration prepares to grapple with these issues, his opinion is going to resonate very strongly in this town and internationally. And finally, and most importantly, something we were just talking about is what a lot of observers don't tend to realize, especially from foreign governments or outside, that it's not just the administration, but it's the Congress and the American people's perception of these issues that's going to drive the dynamics in Washington over the next several years. And with his 18 years in Congress, his work to build support for the WTO and China's accession, his administration, economic, and now cutting-edge UF creative industry work, there's no better person to address these issues. So I join all of CSIS in welcoming Dan Glickman and say we're very much looking forward to his insights and thoughts on this key issue. So thank you very much, Secretary.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Stephen, very much, and thanks for inviting me here. I see some of my old friends here, some I've known for many years, some who used to work at MPAA, and I don't know if he's here spying on me or what, but whatever. I'm delighted to be here. I'm reminded I first went to China as a member of Congress in 1981, And it was pretty early on. I mean, it was pretty bleak there, to be honest with you, in terms of pollution and very few cars on the street. And I recall we went to the Great Wall of China, and I went on a congressional delegation, and I brought my cowboy hat with me. And it was a big hit. Wherever I went, they hadn't seen a lot of cowboy hats. And I went on the top of the Great Wall, and it was in a high wind, and the wind blew the hat off the wall on the north side. And I was kind of, you know, what do I do now? So I got one of our Chinese guards to get me off the wall, and I felt like I chased it all the way into Mongolia. But we never found it. So in any event, that was early on in 1981. I've been back 7 or 8 times since then, both my congressional days. I was chairman of the House Intelligence Committee for a couple of years in my USDA days, and now in this particular job. So I feel like I know the place. I feel like I like China very much. And as Stephen mentioned, while I was Secretary of Agriculture, President Clinton sent me to China with 5 members of Congress to try to sell China's entry into the WTO. And that was, I think, one of the crowning achievements of President Clinton's administration. He personally was probably the most pro-trade president in many generations. I can't tell you how long, but most people acknowledge that he cared personally very much about trade. And in any event, as a result of those trips and the accession of China to the WTO, I felt that our two nations should grow together, and they have, in fact, done that. When I was Secretary of Agriculture, China considered me a staunch ally. After all, China was buying large quantities of American food products. We had some issues involving sanitary and phytosanitary issues involving wheat and other things. But by and large, the Chinese leadership viewed me as one of President Clinton's lieutenants in getting China into the WTO. Today, representing U.S. movie studios, we have had our disagreements between the United States, at least with respect to the movie industry in China. But I remain a friend of China. I think it is an extraordinarily important economic and political power and very important to the United States. I would like to see some changes in Chinese policy as it reflects trade and intellectual property rights, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But I want a bright future for China, as all Americans should. I went to the Olympics on August. I reminded that I was first there 30 years ago. There's probably been no more transformative place on earth, maybe in the history of the world, as what's happened in China the last 30 years. So it is an extraordinary place. And I, as I said, I want a bright future for it, as all Americans should. In my old job at USDA, we grew popcorn. In my new job, we sell popcorn. And in both jobs, China is a major recurring theme. This is one of the most important relationships for our country, and we have to get it right. And the truth is, this relationship is not yet what it could be for either of our countries or for the world. We've had a historic and decisive election here in the U.S., and it gives us a moment of fresh opportunity, fresh possibility for our relationship with China and many other critical allies around the world. Before the MPAA, as Stephen mentioned, I spent time at the Kennedy School. I ran something called the Institute of Politics there. Then Dean of the Kennedy School, Joe Nye, coined the phrase soft power, the notion that America's influence extends beyond military and economic might to the timeless appeal of our values, democracy, freedom, creativity, opportunity, advanced by legions of Americans from academics to artists. Movies are among our most important diplomats in that context. The New York Times noted just last week that while our president is unpopular in many circles, our movies still do very well overseas. As one studio exec put it, Batman is Batman, regardless if Bush is in the White House or not. As film continues to evolve into a global art form, I believe this ambassadorial role would become more of a two-way street. This is a good thing. It gives us all a stake in the industry's success and advances the understanding and camaraderie movies inspire. We hope to see a strong, dynamic Chinese film industry and film industries around the world that can add the product to the number of people who watch movies everywhere. Let's take China. Take the movies like Quantum of Solace, the latest James Bond film, Iron Man, Hancock in that great movie, The Mummy 3. But they all cracked the top 10 this year in China, warmly embraced by Chinese audiences and welcomed into the country by the Chinese government. The most successful U.S. film this year in China was Kung Fu Panda. It was the highest-grossing animated film in Chinese history. The panda, of course, is a national symbol. The film celebrates Chinese culture, and it was made in America. Many asked why China couldn't have made this film themselves. The answer given to a reporter anonymously was, quote, "China has first-class directors, first-class playwrights, first-class actors, but it's a shame that we have censorship by government officials." The censors, the article said, would object to a panda with weight problems. Does it suggest a lazy nation? The life and spirit would have been redlined out of the film. In our country, we're fortunate. Anything goes, and it does sometimes. We celebrate freedom and diversity in films like Milk, which portrays the life of our nation's first openly gay elected official. We see it in the film Frost Nixon, which deals with a revealing series of interviews President Nixon gave after leaving office with echoes of the modern debate over executive powers. We see expression of film expression in the movie W. Say what you will about the film. How many countries would allow such a portrait of a sitting head of state? We are a stronger nation respected around the world for these freedoms. And I recognize that not everybody is exactly in the same place as we are in the scheme of development. But they do underscore our differences with China run far deeper than just pure economics. This country, the U.S., is both a modern, thoroughly modern superpower and a proud nation steeped in millennia of culture. A mere 232 years old, we are the new kids on the block. Our relationship cannot be boiled down to economics, but it is one important aspect. Clearly, piracy is a big problem, but it's not just a movie problem. It affects music, computer software, pharmaceuticals, fashion, the automotive industry, aviation, and agriculture. These IP industries account for one half of the U.S. gross domestic product. As more countries pursue their own innovation economies, I believe that we will see rising global support for intellectual property rules and rights. This is no longer an American issue, but one increasingly meaningful to all who create value with their minds. Now, with respect to this problem as we deal with it in the world, we estimate that we lose about $6 billion in annual losses to the U.S. movie studios due to global piracy. But the total global cost to the motion picture industry is 3 times as high when you consider all filmed entertainment. About 2.7 billion of these losses occur in China, where 9 out of 10 DVDs sold on the streets are illegal copies. Often lost in the debate is the fact that U.S. studios account for just 10% of those losses. A full 90% is the damage done to China's film industry, filmmakers, theaters, retail outlets. So there is a growing shared stake in China itself. Contributing to the problem is the artificial restriction on supply and demand. Of the hundreds of films, U.S. films released annually, about almost 900, out of those are about 225 studio films, and hundreds around the world, but of the U.S. films, no more than 20 are permitted to be seen in Chinese theaters. Now, let me repeat this exactly. The Chinese will allow up to 20 films to be shown that come in on a revenue-sharing basis, which is the normal way you would show movies from overseas. And out of that 20, about 14 are American films. This fuels the black market for these essentially forbidden films. It's the movie equivalent of the old Washington rule. If you want someone to read your memo, mark it confidential. So the fact of the matter is you can go on the streets of Beijing and Shanghai and most cities in China and find just about any movie ever made. most of them not done with the consent of the owner, however. I'll tell you a little story. My son is a film producer, and he produced a movie called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It was not a monumental success, but it was okay, and it did pretty well with it. And I was over in China, and we went to a DVD store. I walked into the store. Actually, he had two movies out at the same time. One was called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and the other one was called The Pacifier with Vin Diesel. I don't know how many of you saw that movie, but it's okay if you didn't. I won't ask you to raise your hands. Any event, so I said to the theater owner, he's showing me all, I mean, in the DVD store, he was showing me everything that he had, and I just commented that, oh, that's an interesting one. So I bought it. I bought two counterfeit DVDs, my son's. And that evening I met with one of the Chinese film bureaucrats, a woman I'd met with before, and I was talking about film piracy, and so she's probably thinking in her mind, there they go again, another American who's just hitting us over the head on piracy. And then I said, but this is different, madam. This is personal. This was produced by my son. And I could see that it had impact, and within 24 hours, that store had been closed. All right. So some people thought that I ought to just permanently be over and put my son's name on every movie coming out of the United States, and we would have been okay. I mean, I don't mean to overstate that particular story, but the fact of the matter is, and there are legitimate outlets for some DVDs in China as well, and there's an attempt by our studios to do that. But the society has pretty much accepted the counterfeit or the pirate, at least with respect to the DVD and CD market, is part of the culture, and that's one of the things that we're fighting very hard. The rapidly emerging reality in this connected era of the Internet is that governments cannot shut out the world. Technology and natural human curiosity will find a way to reopen the doors. So the question is, how do we reopen the doors constructively? Embracing intellectual property rights and open markets would be a profound statement of China's status as a world leader and what kind of a leader it aims to be. If U.S. studios had greater access, they might invest in more local ventures, similar to the collaboration now between Hollywood and India's Bollywood film community, where there is a dramatically growing interplay and collaboration. There's no underestimating the importance of President-elect Obama's efforts to repair our international relationships. I'm sure that CSIS has talked about it. There was, in some circles, without trying to be overly partisan, there was this kind of collective sigh of relief overseas to people when people saw the results of the last American election. And in this context, film and television drive about $60 billion in annual U.S. economic activity and support almost 1.5 million jobs. We in our industry need the world. About 37-38% of theatrical production for U.S. films is sold in the United States. About 62-63% is sold outside the United States. We are the only industry that has a positive balance of payment surplus with every single country in the world we do business with. So you see that we are really an export-dependent industry in the world. And therefore, it's easy for me, the MPAA chairman, to be pro-trade. America, as I said, America's movies run the surplus. Once in a while, China's not in, and we're not in surplus with them, but we are many years. And as I told you, a big percentage of our box office and home video receipts come from outside the United States. Take the movie Quantum of Solace, the last James Bond film. It dominated 5 weeks of global box office. It passed the $500 million mark this past weekend. About 70% of that number came from outside the United States. The film premiered in London and opened in more than 60 countries, from China to Chile to the Czech Republic, all before premiering in the United States, by the way. I recently returned from Singapore and the world's first 3D film festival. While I was there, I sat down with local film students, and I can tell you that this notion of soft power, of the unique and enduring value of movies and their impact on the world and the sense of community that they nurture, translates into many languages. And that is why issues of intellectual property rights and free and fair trade are important. They allow the next stories to be told and shared with the world. The Chinese say the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. The Obama administration's first steps will be quite meaningful. Much is changing in our world. Technology, globalization, and the rise of new superpowers. There is no going back, only moving forward, constructively and with respect for our differences and the great mutual benefit that can come from a stronger U.S.-China relationship. So I thank you very much for the opportunity to join you and share my thoughts with you, and I look forward to attempting to answer your, I'm sure, many very hard questions. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for that excellent overview based on all your different experiences, and I'll ask a couple of questions to kick things off and then open it up to the group for other thoughts. You mentioned as a friend of China, and also many other people that I think are friends of China's have still been frustrated over the last decade as we've continually pushed IPR issues, things like the Strategic Economic Dialogue, but have limited success. Some have said that this is because of the lack of central Chinese government control over the provinces. Others have said, and you hear this particularly in Congress, saying, well, if they can crack down on Olympic copyrights and have an authoritarian government, why can't they do more? And how can we expect anyone to do intellectual property rights enforcement if the Chinese can't do it? You've been both a member of an incoming administration and of Congress. Where do you expect them to go on this, and what would be your advice in terms of how they try to get concrete results in the years ahead?
Well, first of all, I think that the Olympic experience shows that when the Chinese want to deal and control with IPR theft, they can. The streets of most of the major cities in China were pretty free of pirated everything during the Olympics. Certainly, totally free of pirated Olympic material, where you were subject to severe criminal penalties if those were replicated. But even the our goods and manufacturing goods and other goods. So I guess my point here is that this is not an impossible thing. And I think that what we've seen from our experience, I think if you talk with the folks at NBC Universal who televised the Olympics, that they had a positive experience from the authorities in protecting its signals from theft. So it certainly can be done. But I would argue, if you look at the situation today, that the current economic crisis makes this problem more serious than before. And that if we don't protect IPR, our economic losses will be far worse in this rapidly changing economy. And also keep in mind that there are industries here that are successful industries in America, that like ours, but others as well, that need that protection in order to continue to produce jobs. So this ought to be a high priority issue. And the third point I would make is that it's in China's interest to protect its investments as well, intellectual property. They're growing, they're rapidly changing. They're a competitor to the world. They're good manufacturers. They don't need to copy forever what other people do. They can be very successful on their own. And finally, let me just say that from a political context, most administrations have tried to be open and fair in trade. I mean, with Clinton and Bush, and you just look back, the impediments to trade almost invariably come from the American people through their congressmen. And Congress is much as responsible for trade policy as any administration will be. And my experience with President Clinton is it took somebody so committed to trade. I mean, he was a zealot on trade. And even then it was tough. But it's very difficult for an administration to really control Congress unless Congress hears back from the people that what's happening is in their best interest. And that's why I think that for Chinese leadership, I would say that, one, they just can't focus on who the president is. That would be a mistake. And the other thing is that if they really want to help their case, they would recognize that this IPR issue is one that has great influence on the Congress and a lot of the IP industries, and they ought to take note of that.
One last question before I open up to broader discussion. You mentioned, and I think you made a very strong point in your speech about analyzing this battle, about how there's a shared stake, including among Chinese movie producers and their own domestic industry.
I know with USTR and some others, there's also strong interest by the Europeans. You would think the Japanese and others in protecting intellectual property rights. But there's been some difficulty internationally in terms of coordinating an allied response to this. I know you've done some groundbreaking work and working with Chinese movie producers and others. How do you think we can build more of a perception that this isn't just a U.S.-specific fight? And have you experienced, as there's been reported in some other cases in China, pressure by the Chinese government, either on trading partners or domestically, to not participate in these efforts to kind of highlight IPR violations?
Well, I mean, anecdotally, I know about the latter, but I don't know enough to comment personally. I'd make a couple of comments here. Number one is that we've met with a lot of Chinese participants in the film and television industry, actors, producers. They're very cognizant of these issues, and there is a growing pressure that their work is subject to copying, and so. I think that that's something we have to continue to work on. The second thing is that my last few trips to China, I'd met with Chinese entrepreneurs and Chinese business people and people under the age of 40, and those people who are in the world of capitalism for the first time. And sometimes I think the only thing Americans do when they go over to China is meet with government officials. This is a different world. There is a whole group of people out there that are changing their country in China, and we need to be building those bilateral relationships with peers in the business world, in the academic world, because there is much greater, freer expression at that level. So I think that's another thing. The third thing I would say is, we have involved ourselves in a WTO case. The government filed the case, of course, but we were helpful to the government. When we did file that case, 13 other countries joined the case as third parties supporting the United States. So there are some reluctance of some governments and some other U.S. industries to take on the Chinese interest in these areas, and that may be motivated by inside China. I don't know for sure, but I hope that's changing. I think that this is just a constant battle to reinforce that the Chinese need to live up to their international obligations, which we so fought so hard to get them into.
I'd like to open it up to any questions from the audience. Right. And we have a microphone.
Mr. Neil Gillen, who I've known for some time.
Right. Dan, I'm familiar with the accession agreement as it involved agriculture. I'm curious, given the limitation on motion picture products coming into China, how did the U.S.-Chinese accession agreement deal with products such as motion pictures?
With respect to the market access provisions, there was an agreement ultimately worked out by, I guess it was, I don't know if it was Charlene or Mickey, one of them who was handling this, that the 20 motion picture entry number was put in. I think theoretically it was to be a floor, but of course it's become a ceiling in the process. I mean, that was part of the negotiations at the time. I wasn't in that world at that particular time period, but we thought that was an opening. And the problem is it's been a ceiling and it's never really changed very much. And so. There are more theaters being built in China, however, and that may offer more opportunities to get more films in there. But I'm not beyond that. I'm not exactly sure why the 20 was picked. I'm sure it was a compromise.
Way in the back, right there.
Hello. I like to tell a very short joke and then the question.
Good. Can I use it then?
Yes.
Is it copyrighted or can I
no.
repeat it? Okay.
This
fine.
Joke is now circulating around Chinese universities. In 1949, when Mao came to power, the slogan was only socialism can save China. When Deng Xiaoping came to power in 1979, it was only capitalism can save China. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, the slogan was that only China can save socialism. And now the current slogan is that only China can save capitalism.
Is that in China or in the United States? I'm trying to figure out.
I think it's the world.
Okay.
The question, as a politician, I am sure that you know, the politics has a lot to do with perception. And the question is related to your very provocative title to your talk. Can United States save democracy, and how?
Can the United States save democracy?
And how can it be done?
I'll repeat it with a story, but not a joke, per se. I was overseas. Actually, I was in Hong Kong a few years back, and I was talking with some Chinese film producers about American movies, and they were commenting about how people liked American movies, that they didn't like American politics, but they liked the movies and they liked American people. And I said, why do you like American movies? And the answer was not, I thought it was going to be special effects or, you know, one of the Batman movies or computer-generated techniques or anything else. And the response was, because in your movies, you always have the little guy taking on the system. The system might be a corporate system, it might be a government system, it might be your neighbor, but you will often have the little guy taking on the powerful. That's kind of the theme of the movies. We like that because that's an ethic that we would like to emulate, and it's very much a part of the American ethic that anybody can make a difference in their life. It doesn't matter where you come from. It may be harder in some circles than others, but and so I would say to you that one of the things about this industry, one of the reasons why I'm an advocate of promoting it, is not just because our companies make a lot more money when we can protect our products with private copyright laws. I think that's obviously part of the job here. But the real job is that American values and American culture are often represented quite nicely in the product that we produce. Now, would I tell you that every movie that comes out is deserving of the Nobel Peace Prize? No. A lot of it is pretty bad. But a lot of it is pretty darn good. And it makes a difference in people's lives. So I don't know exactly how America will save democracy either at home or around the world except through basic principles of freedom and liberty. But I think the free expression of ideas unimpeded by government is probably the best way you're going to get that done. And that's why the films – let me tell you about one other thing. Only one in every 10 films makes money in the theatrical box office. Only one in 10. Maybe two in 10 sometimes. But it depends. A lot of the films – the average MPAA member film it costs about $95 to $100 million to make and market. So there are films produced for less, but I'm just talking about the major studio films. Okay. So if the average film only maybe is one or two out of 10 that makes money, why do we produce films? And people say, you're nuts, you can't make money. And the answer is because there's the home video market and the video on demand market and the aftermarket. So the DVD market is very much a part of this thing. And everything from Netflix to your video on demand on cable and everything else is very important. Piracy is a dagger in the heart of all that part of the business, because if you can get the product on the street or you can download it illegally on the internet, then people will not buy into that aftermarket, which makes it a lot less likely than you're going to produce a first-rate movie in the first place. So I just thought I'd mention that as well. Yes, sir.
I'm Luke Engen, a reporter from Inside U.S. Trade. I wanted to ask about the WTO case. Do you see any decision points before the incoming Obama administration as far as how it approaches this ongoing case? And how much of a setback is it that the Europeans and perhaps some other U.S. sectors disagree whether or not film as a service are good?
I can't tell you exactly when we're going to get a word on that case. Pretty soon is all I can tell you. I think it's going to happen, but I don't know. Certainly nothing publicly has been disseminated yet, except in only very general terms. you know, we had a fair amount of support, and there were some industries that didn't support us. But to a large extent, movies and music have been the poster children for this problem. So we have led the way. And we understand that people have different economic and political issues to deal with. But by and large, we've been satisfied with the support we've gotten.
Right there, second row.
Hi, I'm Rodney Farron from the Crumpton Group. But before this, I spent 3 years working in Los Angeles at the Walt Disney Company, setting up their intelligence program and supporting Steve Zydek and others.
Okay,
with you.
Yeah, he knows much more than I do about any of this.
But here's the question. It's clear that we're fighting this war on piracy. In your estimation, taking a snapshot right now, do you think we're winning? Are we losing? And what has been the most effective enforcement tool? Has it been public education, government action, or private investigation enforcement?
I think we're holding our own on physical piracy. I mean, you know, for a lot of different reasons, it will probably always be there because counterfeit materials are just, you know, ubiquitous and all over the place, and we do our best to go after them. And I'm worried about the online world because it is, while we are using technology the best way we can to deal with it and have had some success, it requires an enormous amount of resources and a lot of cooperation with law enforcement around the world. The online world is just something, it's phenomenally new, and we haven't quite figured out technologically how to deal with it. It's particularly troubling among younger people who believe that if it's online, it's theirs, and it doesn't belong to anybody else. I'd say the strategies have to be comprehensive. So enforcement has to be part of a strategy, but so does education, particularly at the K through 8 level, because once you get into college, it's almost too late to deal with people. But we have programs at university levels as well. It requires technological solutions so you can identify the product through filtering or watermarking and that kind of thing. And finally, our studios and the industry have to develop alternatives to people so they can get reasonably priced product in a hassle-free, cheap, reasonably priced, I won't say cheap, reasonably priced way. Because my experience tells me that if the material is out there, you can buy it. And that's what iTunes found out, that people didn't want to buy a whole CD. They wanted to buy one song. And it was reasonably priced. So now you're beginning to see a plethora of services out there. You can get video entertainment through a lot of different ways at reasonable price. And so all those things together, I think, are part of a total strategy. It can't be just one part.
Way in the back. Hi, my name is Scott Augenbaugh. I'm a web assistant here at CSIS. I have a question. You just brought up a point that I wanted to talk about. I spent some time in Beijing in 2004, and I studied at Beijing University, and we had a movie night. And what came up is one of the students wanted to go show an American movie to us, so she went out and bought Spider-Man. So she came back with Spider-Man. I asked her how much it cost, and it cost essentially the equivalent of $1. Mm-hmm. So recently I went over to Best Buy, and it cost $9.99 to buy a DVD.
Best Buy in the U.S.? Or
Best Buy in the U.S.
Okay.
I know there's. I mean, China's made some major gains recently, but that's still a very large divide in the actual DVD content. And I know it's still pretty hard to find good internet cafes depending on where you are in Beijing, but I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that as far as the physical, because the physical DVD was very easy to obtain there still.
Well,
at a dollar.
Some of the studios have, over the last few years, experimented with offering DVD product at not quite the dollar level, but at prices close, between $2 and $3 in some cases. So you could buy legal product at prices which approached, not equaled, but approached what you can get on the pirate level. You know, look, China's a tough place for a lot of different reasons. My guess is that the government authorities, some of them at least, have historically not been really interested in cracking down on this because it gives the common folk a point of entertainment at pretty cheap prices, and
and it's probably a political decision on their part to give people that comfort level. And in addition to that, there wasn't the same kind of developed legal system in China as there was here and every place else. And you have all sorts of problems with demographics in China and people moving into the cities in great numbers. And I understand all of that. And so that's why I'm probably more understanding of where they are than they might think I am. I'm just saying that now that they are rapidly industrializing and they have growth maybe 8% this year, I don't know, at worst 7%, somewhere between 7 and 9%, and the amount of jobs and the trade imbalance that occurs, you know, they're reaching the point where they can no longer argue that they're in the backwoods. They're in the front woods now, and they're if it weren't for their capital, we would not be able to be financing the program to bail out our savings and loans in our financial institutions for all practical purposes. So they really need to get with the law, not the game, but the law as it relates to intellectual property, because they can't have it both ways. It can't be heads I win, tails you lose. And that's where the intellectual property argument has kind of been to date. The argument is we don't have the same system as you do. It's going to take us a longer time to get there, those kinds of issues. But they're moving very rapidly. There's no question about it.
Hi, my name is Seamus Kraft. What do you think has been the most successful forum to deal with U.S.-China IPR issues, and why?
You know, I can't answer that question because, you know, ultimately the threat of a WTO action is always out there to kind of. I don't think either we or the Chinese really want to go down that road, but we think we've been forced to do that. But, you know, you can't separate it from the larger issues between the U.S. and China. And so I think the most valuable thing the new administration can do is to continue its effort to have constructive dialogue with China on a variety of issues, from diplomatic, national security issues, climate change, currency and financial things, but also to keep on top of the IPR things. I mean, I think that ultimately China will come into the community of nations on these issues, but they need to hear from us. And when they don't hear from us, it's a deafening silence. In fact, I talked to some members of Congress who went over there, and they had these meetings with high-level government officials, and they forgot to mention something about IPR, and apparently in some of the traffic that we read said they must not care because they didn't mention it. So I mean, it is really it's really important that we keep on top of this.
Hi, Willie Wilson. China's a complicated place, as you know. To what extent does the MPAA or other people seeking to enforce work with provincial or city-level authorities in an attempt to try to solve the problem on a micro level first?
That's a good point. When I've gone there, I've always met with the mayors, but, you know, they've been mayors of big cities. The mayors are wonderful. A mayor of Shanghai is like the mayor of Chicago. I mean, he's interested in the same things, keeping the streets clean, keeping the traffic moving, keeping jobs in the area, you know. And so what I found is the mayors are really dedicated to prioritization of services. And so I remember visiting the mayor. It was either of Shanghai or of Beijing, and I don't remember. It was in the last 3 or 4 years. One of the times I was there where he basically said to us, "We got to get this stuff off the streets." I know that. He says it's just there's a lot of other things we have to do too. So mayors are very practical people. But in addition to mayors, I repeat the fact, we need to be talking with entrepreneurs, young people. There's just a whole new group of Chinese, talented Chinese people who are making an impact in their own country, younger for the most part, and they're going to be the leaders the next 10, 15, or 20 years. And so we just can't only go to the Great Hall of the People and think we're going to get everything solved.
Right up here in the front.
Loretta Green with the Department of Commerce. You mentioned that we need to get in touch with these young entrepreneurs. But let me ask you this. How do we get beyond the government officials? How can we get that dialogue going?
You know what? I think it's easier. I mean, you obviously can talk to your foreign commercial officers and everything else. But the last few times I've been there, I've been fairly successful in meeting folks who are not government officials. But, you know, you got to get into the network somehow. And, and, and find out who these people are. And at times it may be easier for us, because of our commercial context, to go in and as opposed to government officials. But I do think that there is a rapidly growing entrepreneurial class there, and we need to figure out ways to engage it.
Maybe there could be some website started? Or?
I don't know about websites in China, you know, but could be.
Second row.
Yeah.
Paramis Warren from Agence France-Presse. You spoke about the current financial crisis and piracy and perhaps some worry about maybe the question is whether you worry that the piracy levels would increase amid this crisis, and whether there will be efforts, government efforts towards fighting this problem would lag, and how would the crisis actually affect turnover of movies, for example, U.S. movies, and is there a forecast for this year in relation to last year, and whether there would be some reduction?
Well, these are good questions, and there's several of them. But first of all, the general belief is that the box office for movie theaters has historically tended to withstand recessions. Five out of the last recessions, box office went up when everything else went down, and there are a lot of reasons for that. By and large, it's reasonably priced entertainment. You know, even in this country, a $10 ticket is cheaper than a lot of other forms of entertainment. A big chunk of movie audiences are people under the age of 30 years old. They're going to go out no matter what. This is part of their lives. They want to be social. And movies are a great place to do that kind of thing. So I'm more worried about the home video market in a tough period of time. But we'll see. This whole recession now is a little bit a case of first impression, because it happened so fast. We don't really know where it's going to take us. I think in terms of piracy, what I think concerns us is that whether, because of economic difficulties, more and more people will find pirated product attractive to take, whether on the streets or online. And I think we don't have any statistics along that line. And then, you know, it's going to be the way you finance movies, you have to have credit. Credit is the lifeblood of movie financing. So if you don't have much credit flowing around, it's going to impact the cost of producing a movie in the first place. And piracy losses are going to be a bigger and bigger factor as the production costs go up because of higher credit. So that's how I would answer that question.
Other questions? We have time maybe for one more question, anyone?
The limitations on USTR bringing an action is the fact that outside counsel cannot do the work. In almost every other country, that's not the case. I was just wondering, what are your personal feelings on that, and would your industry be willing to work with other industries to change that policy, either through regulation or statute, if and when you can convince an administration to make the foreign policy decision to defend an industry, then you're not subject to the limitations of the OGC's office and the USTR.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. We've actually talked about this before, about that the restrictions put us at a disadvantage vis-a-vis particularly other governments and other corporate entities that are located overseas. I don't think we've really taken a specific position on this, but what you say sounds something that we ought to look at very closely.
And one kind of quick follow-on on this, too, and something you mentioned earlier about how in various fora the idea of a WTO case was kind of helping to push along action. Now, I know there was some hesitancy on some quarters in going forward with a case because of the perception that it would be very high stakes in terms of how it comes out and whether we win or get a partial victory or win, and then it still doesn't have the kind of impact. What do you think are the stakes in this case, And what are, if it doesn't achieve everything we're hoping it to, what do you think are the other mechanisms we can use to try to...
Well, first of all, yeah, you know, I mean, naturally we hope we win. We think we, the government had a very good case here. And, you know, I mean, the net result could be a big win, a partial loss, a big loss. We don't know. Regardless of what it is, I'm sure that the trade lawyers as well as governments will noodle over the results for a fairly extensive period of time. You know that because you've worked there before. So you have to, we have to continue to work the political, the government-to-government side of this picture very aggressively, notwithstanding the case.
And with that, I'd just like to thank you for coming.
Thank you for being here.
This has been a fascinating discussion.
Okay.